If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Happy Monday, everyone. Seth Meyers here. Today we have a brand new edition of our special podcast series, Midterm Cram, in which late night staffers Sal Gentile and Henry Melcher guide you through the issues that matter the most in the upcoming elections. I'm excited for you to hear today's episode. Sal and Henry talk to Sarah Cliff, the senior policy correspondent for Vox, who focuses on healthcare. They also touch on other stories making headlines in the home stretch before November 6th. Without further ado, here are Sal and Henry.
Hey, Sal.
Hey, Henry.
We are recording this on Friday. We are about a week and a half from the midterms.
That's right.
Yeah. And in this episode, we talked to Sarah Cliff. She's a senior policy correspondent at Vox and really one of the best people we could possibly talk to about healthcare. We wanted to talk about healthcare because there have been so many stories during the midterm campaign about Trump, about individual things candidates have done. But healthcare has kind of remained the number one issue voters are concerned about. So we wanted to talk to her as an expert about the state of healthcare and how people are running on it. But before we do that, we wanted to recap some of the insane, crazy things that have been happening in the past couple of weeks as, you know, early voting has started.
Yeah, because it can feel like the day-to-day news is like, you know, Trump misspelling the word emergency and stuff like that. But there are very intense races happening in states across the country. So, for example, in Georgia, where Brian Kemp is running against Stacey Abrams, there's this voter purge happening. Mm-hmm. Brian Kemp actually privately expressed concern that people were going to go to the polls and vote.
Quote, exercise their right to vote.
Yes. He's extremely concerned about people exercising their right to vote.
The Secretary of State.
Yes. Who is in charge of administering the state's elections.
Is worried about people in his state exercising their right to vote.
So it's an incredible insight into the Republican mindset about whether people should actually be able to vote or not. So that happened in Georgia. But one of the most incredible things, and it was truly cathartic to see, because so much of our political oxygen is sucked up by Donald Trump, and the awful things that Republicans are doing and the lies that they're telling about things like healthcare, that it was so cathartic to see this moment from the Florida gubernatorial debate between Democrat Andrew Gillum and Republican Ron DeSantis. And the Republican candidate, Ron DeSantis, had been asked about his associations with racist figures. And Andrew Gillum had this incredible response during the debate. Let's play it real quick.
Mr. DeSantis has spoken. Hey, first of all, he's got neo-Nazis helping him out in this state. He has spoken at racist conferences. He's accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim, N-I-G-G-E-R. When asked to return that money, he said no. He's using that money to now fund negative ads. Now, I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
That is an incredible line.
It is incredible.
He clowned on Ron DeSantis so hard. What you don't hear after that clip is Ron DeSantis then slipped on a banana peel, fell headfirst into a garbage can, ran into the wall, knocked himself unconscious, and peed his pants. Like, that's how embarrassing that was for him. And this is not like some sort of Twitter own. Like, it's not just like, oh, wow, watch people dunk on Charlie Kirk or some conservative twerp on Twitter. It's like a Democratic gubernatorial candidate absolutely, in the most embarrassing way, wrecked his opponent on stage.
Yeah.
And again, like, it was just so cathartic to see because Republicans are, in many cases, running like these explicit completely racist campaigns against their Democratic opponents, like upstate New York, where John Faso is running this campaign, essentially saying his Democratic opponent, who was a Rhodes Scholar, because he like briefly had a rap album, like
Delgado.
Yeah, Delgado in upstate New York. Like, because of that, like, he's literally running ads of people like saying, like, his voice is not our voice, and people don't talk like that around here. Like, an explicitly racist campaign against him. And so it was just amazing to see that.
Well, they're running these explicitly racist campaigns, and it's really nice to have just a Democrat explicitly call it out for being what it is.
Yeah,
like, that clarity from the other side was just so so enjoyable to see.
And aside from running these explicitly racist campaigns, as we mentioned earlier, one of the biggest things that Republicans are doing is just lying through their teeth about health care.
Yes, they are lying through their teeth. They are now saying they are the ones that will protect pre-existing conditions despite voting against the Affordable Care Act, which protects pre-existing conditions. Democrats, of course, around the country, many of them are running on Medicare for All. Suddenly, Republicans are saying that Medicare for All will strip them of the Medicare they have now if they're over 65. The lies are brazen and extraordinary.
It's really incredible. I mean, it feels to me, and this is saying a lot, like the most brazen lie of Donald Trump's presidency so far, because he's saying something that is the opposite of what is demonstrably true. Like, he's not just concocting a crazy fantasy. Like, he said Obama had tapped his wires and, like, he had secret tapes of James Comey. Like, he can invent things out of whole cloth. But to look down the barrel of a camera and just say, I am going to protect your pre-existing conditions, Democrats will not, is just so brazen it's disorienting.
Yeah.
And so we talked to Sarah Cliff. About it.
She is the senior policy correspondent for Vox. She's the host of the Impact podcast. There's a trailer for the second season of that now, and the second season drops this Friday. We Skyped with her. She's in D.C. We Skyped with her from New York.
This was a great week to talk to her because she got called out by the White House.
Yep.
Really the best person we could possibly talk to about this topic.
It's a get.
That's right. It's a get. We landed a big one.
Here's Sarah Cliff. All right. We are here with Sarah Cliff, probably the preeminent healthcare reporter in America. Can we
Almost
say that?
Certainly.
I think that's...
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. We are so... excited to talk to you.
Very excited. Cited by the White House this week, which I want to get to at some point. That just shows how preeminent you are.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So we've been doing this podcast for a few months, and we've been talking about all these national issues that are affecting the midterms and then, you know, state by state issues. But it seems like healthcare has been kind of the top line major issue that's driving voters. Why do you think it is and has been the number one issue that voters are concerned about?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a few things going on. It's really interesting to me, given that healthcare has been a really difficult political issue, that Democrats seem to have lost a lot of seats in 2010 after they passed the Affordable Care Act, that everyone, Democrats, Republicans, they still want to keep talking about healthcare. And I think that's because there's just a lot of challenges in our healthcare system that haven't been solved. If you look at public polling, a lot of people are really frustrated with healthcare prices, particularly the prices of prescription drugs are still driving people kind of crazy. And then there's also this really bruising battle we've had over Obamacare repeal over the past year. So you're seeing a lot of the debate center around protecting people with pre-existing conditions. And you're seeing a lot of what I think is really, really upsetting and disingenuous messaging on the part of Republicans around pre-existing conditions. So I think it's because it's an issue that's personal. A lot of people care about it and it still has a lot of challenges.
Let's talk about the pre-existing condition
issue.
Let's get
into that.
It's wild.
I want to start out by first asking you, just as a reporter, what's the experience of how brazen it is? Because for me, it's actually so brazen that it's reminiscent of in particular Donald Trump, but it's the entire Republican Party's healthcare messaging, essentially. It's like reminiscent of some of his craziest lies. Like, I was thinking, for example, when he, in the closing days of the campaign, he was like, I didn't start the birther movement, Hillary Clinton did. It's not just that he's concocting a crazy fantasy, he's literally brazenly saying the exact opposite of what is demonstrably true, which is he's saying, I will protect pre-existing conditions, Democrats will not. So for you as a person trying to figure out how to like relay this to your audience, report on it, like, does it feel as brazen to you as it does to the rest of us?
Yes. It kind of feels like I'm living in a world where people keep saying, no, 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 the sky's like clearly green. And then because I work at Vox, I have to write all these explainers about, no, the sky's blue. Because, like, you know, but it's not like, you know, there's a lot of policy areas where I feel like sometimes we don't know what people think and we're trying to suss it out, like Medicare for All. Like, I think there's a lot of senators who say, I support Medicare for All. I don't really know what that means. But because we've had this huge fight over healthcare, we have a really good sense of what each party wants to do on pre-existing conditions. And it's very, very different. And just the brazenness of the lying is just, it is, you know, constant. And, you know, it comes from Donald Trump at the very top and then goes all the way down, you know, through a lot of these candidates. So it feels the same to me. And it's a really important issue. Like, the thing that frustrates me is, you know, if Republicans are reelected and if they, you know, I've seen multiple senators say, you know, if we're reelected, if we have enough seats in the Senate, we'll take another stab at Obamacare repeal. So it really matters for about, you know, 100 million or so Americans who have pre-existing conditions, how those are going to be dealt with under federal law. So it's not just like a, you know, lie that, you know, you can just brush aside, that people are, this might be the exact type of issue people want to vote on. And the information out there is very bad and very hard to write about. So yeah, it feels just as brazen to me what's going on. And it feels very different from what I've covered in the past. You know, I've been covering healthcare for about a decade now, and it doesn't feel like the amount of distance between what a policy position is and how legislators are describing it. That seems to have gone much, much wider when I look at, you know, Republican candidates right now.
I do feel like that just makes me and probably some people listening hopefully feel slightly more sane in a way that even to you, it feels different. Like, it's like this is a level of brazenness, just literally looking down the barrel of a camera and saying, I will protect pre-existing conditions, Democrats will not. It's not just that we're all just like exhausted and immune to it now. Like, that does feel like a different level of brazen lying.
It's even gotten worse, though. I saw, you know, that recently a few Republican candidates were saying that the Washington Post, their fact checker, had given Democrats 4 Pinocchios on their statements that they would protect pre-existing conditions, which didn't happen. So now the guy who runs Fact Checker is out there like saying, like trying to combat this. It's really bad.
When we're lying about the fact checks, it's like, do we just give up?
The fact checker is out there trying to fact check people's fact checks. It's crazy.
That is wild. Okay, so the Republicans seem to be saying that we will protect pre-existing conditions, but we're also going to get rid of Obamacare. Can you explain, as a healthcare expert, why that's actually not possible?
I mean, so it is possible.
See, I don't know anything.
Okay. It is not what Republicans have done in the past. So sure, like the Republicans could get rid of Obamacare and create a Medicare for all system, but like that is not what they are proposing. What they're proposing, and what they have proposed in, you know, the previous bills that would repeal Obamacare, is to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and create a system that is much more challenging for someone who is sick and who has a pre-existing condition. So I think like a good thing to look at is one of the bills that's been proposed by a group of Republican senators that they say will protect pre-existing conditions. And this kind of responds to a lawsuit that is currently being pursued by the Trump administration and a number of conservative attorney generals that basically argues that the pre-existing condition protections in Obamacare are illegal. That lawsuit is sitting in front of a judge in Texas right now. We're still waiting for the decision. But then we saw a group of Republican senators say, oh, crap, this would be bad if protections for pre-existing conditions went away. So they introduced this bill that says people in the United States, if you have pre-existing conditions, don't worry, you can still buy health insurance. Unfortunately, that bill comes with a huge caveat. The insurance doesn't have to cover your pre-existing condition. So like, you know, you breast cancer survivor, breast cancer patient, you are guaranteed access to health insurance. However, you are not guaranteed access to health insurance that would cover your breast cancer treatment. So like they can say, and it's totally true, that in their insurance market, people with pre-existing conditions can buy health insurance. But I don't think that's a very good representation of like what people think of when they think of like what you are purchasing for a health insurance package.
This lawsuit you mentioned about pre-existing conditions, this was signed on to, correct me if I'm wrong, by Josh Hawley, who is running against Claire McCaskill in Missouri, who is now running ads saying he would protect pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
Yes. There are a number of conservative Republican attorneys general who have signed on to this lawsuit that basically argues, and the Trump administration is with this as well, that the Department of Justice is supporting a version of this lawsuit, who are arguing that, you know, if you remember in the tax bill that passed just about a year ago, they got rid of the fine for not carrying health insurance. So they are arguing that the individual mandate, because there's no fee and it was saved last time by the courts as a tax, it's no longer a tax. Therefore, the individual mandate is illegal. That might be true. That might not. The place where this gets really controversial is they're arguing that if the individual mandate falls, the entire rest of the Affordable Care Act has to fall, including those protections for pre-existing conditions. And it would be pretty devastating to the Affordable Care Act if this if this lawsuit, you know, were to be successful. And we've seen, you know, a lot of ACA lawsuits make it to the Supreme Court with some pretty close votes. And this is, you know, being pursued by many attorneys general. And you know, they have a choice. They don't have to be part of this lawsuit. The Huffington Post recently asked all of the attorneys generals, are they thinking of pulling off the lawsuit? And the answer was no. So, you know, there is a way for this lawsuit to stop, but it is still going forward. And like you said, it's being led by some people who are currently running for office saying they're going to protect pre-existing conditions.
There's two versions of what's happening. One are they're just saying some who actually voted for the bill are saying brazenly, I want to protect pre-existing conditions. And then there's others who are leaving it more sort of like open, like, oh, we could still do both, as Henry mentioned, like we could eliminate Obamacare and also protect people with pre-existing conditions. And then it's up to people to imagine like how that could theoretically be possible. What's so maddening is there was a bill. There were multiple bills, but there was one bill in particular that Republicans in the House passed, and it had a bunch of very concrete things in it. And the only reason we don't talk about all of those very specific things that it would have done is because the Republicans got super lucky and couldn't get their shit together and actually pass the bill and make it a law. So, like, because they actually got lucky and dodged that bullet, we're now not talking about a bunch of the very specific things that Republicans tried to do. Like, for example, eliminating essential health benefits. Like, that's mm-hmm. another thing that's, like, super concrete that I feel like people understood when the bill was making its way through Congress. And now we don't, like, talk about that at all because, like, Republicans got lucky and didn't pass the bill.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this really stems from the president himself. Like, I think back to, I very specifically remember January of 2017. So Trump has just been elected and he gives us an interview to The Washington Post where he says, I have a great health care plan. It's going to cover everybody. It's going to be cheaper. And like, I very specifically remember I was on Capitol Hill, you know, I was with a swarm of reporters and we're all like, ooh, like, is there a new plan? Like, what is this plan going to be? Like, certainly, like, this was before Trump had even been inaugurated. And, you know, we're all like, well, maybe there is a new plan. Like, no, there is no new plan. Yeah. Like, the plan is the same as the repeal plans we've seen before. And it is true these plans would likely lower premiums, that insurance would cost less under the Republican plans. But it's also true that a number of people would not have access to health insurance, like, or they would have access to health insurance that really wouldn't cover their healthcare needs. And, you know, and I think, like, as I've, like, watched the president's Twitter account around pre-existing conditions, it's the exact same thing. It kind of, you know, it contains this, like, glimmer of hope, like maybe there is a secret plan, you know, maybe he does have this plan to change pre-existing conditions. He's an unconventional Republican. Maybe he's going to do something different than what Republicans did before. But I think from watching the past 2 years of healthcare debate, it seems like there is no secret plan. Like the things we've seen are what are on the table.
The idea that like Trump opens his drawer in the Oval Office and he's like, I actually have been working on a plan. So what I actually think is the markets need to like.
We'll get that with his secret plan to defeat ISIS.
Those are in two. They're next to each other. Yeah. And he's kind of just like dotting his I's, crossing his T's, making sure it's all there.
It's so funny that there was this time when because he was the president and it was like early in his presidency, we did have to take seriously the possibility that he had a plan. He goes in front of reporters and is like, we're going to pass a tax cut in the next week. And reporters are all like, Congress is not in session, man. Like, they're trying to explain to him, like, how it works. And he's like, no. Don't worry. This plan is happening. Like, we're passing a tax cut for middle-income people.
I want to ask about this kind of general sense of covering a president who doesn't know anything about policy, specifically healthcare policy. And there's been so many attempts to repeal Obamacare during the Trump presidency. So what has it been like covering Trump who doesn't know a thing about healthcare? Compared to Obama, who learned a lot and brought in experts.
There was this one moment in the middle of the healthcare debate where I think he said something to President Trump, said something like, who knew healthcare could be so complicated?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And then you hear like the screaming of every health policy reporter.
Especially because like any number of times he specifically said it will be so easy throughout the campaign. He said you'll have free healthcare. Everyone will have
beautiful healthcare.
Beautiful healthcare will be so easy.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, right? I think the challenge is really more with like the brazen lying than it is, you know, I guess it's definitely like as part like the not understanding healthcare. You know, I've written about interviews President Trump has given where it seems pretty clear that he's confusing health insurance and life insurance just by like the size of the premiums that he's talking about. I forget. I don't know which interview he gave, but there was one where it was very clear when I was reading it. I was like, oh, this isn't about health insurance.
Yeah, he said something like you could get it for like $25 or something crazy like that.
It kind of reminded me of like there's a scene in Arrested Development where like they're talking about the price of bananas, and it was like clear, like, you know, like the Blues had like never actually interacted with purchasing a piece of fruit. But then it's like, you know, I remember during the healthcare debate, I remember there's an interview, for example, Secretary Price, who is no longer Secretary Price due to his penchant for private jets. But when he was Secretary Price.
That scandal.
Yeah, that thing that happened. Yeah.
He gave this interview to CNN where he said no one would lose Medicaid under the Republican plans. And that's just like so clearly not true. Like it's just they're going to repeal Medicaid expansion. Like it's just so easy to disprove. So, you know, I read a thing for Vox. It says like, you know, here's the thing he said and here's why it's not true. But I don't know. It's hard. Like at the same point, I'm like repeating the thing that he said. So it's out there more. And like, I am debunking it, but he was already on CNN saying this thing. And I think one of the things that's really hard with like cable news that I do empathize with is it's really hard to do that fact checking in real time. Mm-hmm. You know, especially if you're an anchor, like not a health policy expert, to like be on enough to be able to push back. It's a real challenge, and I don't have like a great solution for how to deal with that.
It does seem though, like given how persistently unpopular all of these bills have been, and given the generic polling advantage that Democrats seem to have on the issue of healthcare broadly, it seems like a preponderance of people like don't believe it. Like it's baked in to people on a very basic level. It's very clear that Republicans are trying to pass bills that would take people's health care away for a lot of people. And like, no matter what they say, like whether Tom Price says like these bills wouldn't take health care away for anyone or Trump says we will protect people with pre-existing conditions, it seems like that is not penetrating.
I don't know. I don't know if that was that is true. And I don't know because of some of the reporting I did right after Donald Trump was elected when, you know, I decided I was really interested in Obamacare enrollees who voted for Trump, who, you know, had watched like, and I was particularly interested in this area of Kentucky that has some of the highest Obamacare enrollment in the country, went like 80-90% for Trump, depending on which county you're in. And so, you know, I went out there to get a sense of like, did people just not follow the election? Did they, you know, like why would they vote for the candidate who seemed to be expressly, you know, arguing for taking their health insurance away? And it kind of came back to this like idea of a secret plan. Like the people I talked to, they were on Obamacare. They knew Republicans wanted to repeal Obamacare, but they, you know, heard President Trump say, you know, I'm going to come up with something better. And they believed it. You know, does that work 2 years later? I don't know. But at least at that point, the rhetoric that was out there, it really influenced how people were voting, that they heard this promise, you know, that he's going to come up with a system that's better than Obama. And they had real frustrations with the Affordable Care Act. Like their deductibles were super high. Some of them were like $6,000. That's pretty rough. So they kind of saw this candidate and thought, you know, he says he's going to fix it, so I'm going to vote for that guy.
You're right. There are like legitimate imperfections, as everyone knows, with Obamacare and the current healthcare system. Democrats, many of them, not all of them, are running proactively on Medicare for All. Do you have a sense of whether there is a unified message on Medicare for All, or are Democrats still figuring it out?
I think they're still figuring it out. I've been really, really surprised at how quickly the Democratic Party has shifted towards Medicare for All. Like if I think back to the 2008 primary, like there was not a single kind of like realistic Democratic candidate who was on a Medicare for All platform. That's like a really big shift that has happened. I don't think it would have happened without this huge repeal assault, actually. I think, you know, Democrats felt like the ACA was kind of their compromise bill. And now that, you know, they're like, well, if Republicans aren't going to get on board with our compromise, like, let's go for the thing we really want, which is more of like a Medicare for All system. I think Bernie Sanders has a really clear vision of what he wants from Medicare for All. I think he wants a system very similar to Canada's. And like, he's someone who's really spent a lot of time thinking about this. I don't think the rest of the field has quite as clear of a vision. And there's a lot of different options. You know, Canada has a single payer system. It's really different from Britain's single payer system, which is really different from the one in Singapore and the one in Australia. There's a lot of different options when you kind of look across the world at how we structure healthcare systems. And I don't think there is consensus at this point. I think this is one of the policy debates I'm really excited to follow in 2020 is like hearing different candidates kind of clarify, okay, what does it mean to expand the Medicare program to everybody? So it's not unified at this point, but it feels like the momentum towards it. And, you know, some of the polling, actually, it's becoming more popular. You know, when I was doing that reporting in Kentucky, one of the things that surprised me, I was not doing reporting on Medicare for All, but I had multiple people who were kind of like frustrated with those high deductibles in Obamacare who said things like, well, I just don't understand why we don't have a system like Canada. And this is like an area that voted 90% for Trump. So I don't think it is quite as it was really interesting to me to hear this come up in like a very Republican area, this kind of like brewing interest in like a Canadian healthcare system. Yeah.
Well, that is the thing that I feel like our political moment has revealed, which is like the things that you think are the views of like traditional Republican and Democratic voters based on like what K Street lobbyists suggest they might be are not actually like there aren't a lot of Republican voters walking around being like, we need market based solutions to like make healthcare accessible to everyone. It's like there was this poll. It's one random poll, so we shouldn't read too much into it. But there was like one random poll that came out this week that showed a majority of Republicans would be fine with Medicare for All. So I feel like we've found out that people don't have these intuitive views that you would think they do based on what people in Washington say they do.
Yeah, and I think the research we have, like the polling research we have now, suggests that views about Medicare for All right now are really fluid. That so there's really interesting polling from Kaiser Family Foundation. They show that, you know, you can swing public opinion by double digit percentage points on Medicare for All, depending on like if you give people arguments for or against it. So it seems like an area where a lot of people haven't quite made up their minds about what they think of it. And I think that's why you see, because, you know, we have this polling that suggests you can really sway people negative or sway them positive. Like why we see Republicans going so hard at this Medicare for All stuff is that they know this is an area where they can sway opinion pretty negative if they make the right arguments.
Is that main argument just this fear of, quote, socialized medicine? Mm-hmm. Is that really the strongest attack you think Republicans have on this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a few arguments I see out of there. You know, some I think are a little more credulous than others. I think the one that's kind of crazy, my favorite is this will end Medicare as we know it. Like, yeah, sure. Like, it'll like end the program we know that is for seniors and expand it to everybody.
It's this insane jujitsu where they know that like it's effective to say to people, we'll protect your Medicare. So by preventing you from expanding Medicare, we will protect your Medicare from being destroyed. It's insane.
It feels like this line that is like written specifically to the fact checkers who are going to be like, well, I guess that's like technically true. It would end Medicare as we know it. But like the implication of it is like so much beyond like what it is they're actually saying. So, I mean, fair, true. It would end Medicare as we know it because it would give Medicare to everybody. You know, then
zero
I think,
Pinocchios.
What?
Zero Pinocchios.
I think right. So like, you, I don't know. I mean, it feels like it deserves
zero Pinocchios, and also like a 100 Pinocchios at the same
time. Yeah.
But we're
like
in
a conference
realm
of like Pinocchios, like a Comic Con where everyone cosplayed as Pinocchio. Like that's what this is.
So that, you know, I don't think is an argument a lot of credence. You know, I think. I think the debates that are worth having is, you know, when you have one government plan that insures everybody, you know, you're not going to have a lot of choice if you're not happy with that health insurance. If they decide, you know, we don't cover this drug because we don't think it's effective and it's very, very expensive. You see this kind of outrage in Britain all the time where like new cancer drugs will roll in the market and they have this cost effectiveness unit that decides, you know, is this worth the price that the drug maker wants to charge. And sometimes they'll say, no, it's not. And it'll lead to like a lot of public outrage because, you know, there's nowhere else to turn. You can't go shopping for health insurance in Canada and very limited shopping in Britain. So I think that's like a fair debate worth having. I think that's something Democrat, like that's one of the debates Democrats are going to have is, you know, is there an outlet for people who want to buy better than the public system? Are we going to allow that? Bernie Sanders says no, like everybody in the public system. But if you look at like Australia or New Zealand or even Britain, like they let people buy competing plans. So I think that's like, you know, a debate that's worth having that some of the Republican critiques do get to.
One example of this weird sort of rhetorical jujitsu they're trying to pull off is they put out this study. The White House put out an official study this week where they tried to debunk socialism, essentially. It's called like the opportunity cost of socialism, which in itself is a title that didn't really seem to make any sense. But then within that report, you were cited, so I want you to explain that.
Yes.
And also, they inadvertently made the case for Medicare for All, for expanding Medicare to everybody. So, first of all, explain how you were compared to Mao Zedong in the study for us.
It's a pretty weird day when you go to work and a White House report compares you to a Chinese revolutionary. So I'll just read you the sentence. So the White House report says, modern journalists and analysts routinely claim that single payer programs are more efficient and thus are similar in spirit to Lenin and Mao, who justified government takeovers on the basis of the virtues of single payer programs. And then if you look at the citation for modern journalists, that's a citation to an article that I wrote in 2014, where I talk about some of the efficiencies of single payer healthcare systems. So I think it is quite a leap to go from thinking single payer systems are efficient to these comparisons to Mao and Lenin.
Well, in fairness, you are wearing a brown tunic right now, and there's a giant painting of you behind you on the wall.
It's weird. I insisted you guys call me a chairwoman, Cliff. Like, I'll take the bait. Like, I'll write about why I think single payer systems are efficient, and I think the reason they're efficient, and the reason, like, it's not like a Maoist or Leninist thing to decide to regulate healthcare prices through the government, which is one of the things that makes single payer systems efficient. Like, unlike our system, where every health insurer, thousands of health insurers, are each setting a different price for an appendectomy, in most other developed countries, and not just like, you know, Nordic liberal state, whatever, but like in the ones that are at the top of the Heritage Economic Freedom Index, they all have government price regulation in their healthcare system. And they do that because it makes the system more efficient and it like controls healthcare costs. And the US is an anomaly in not doing this. It's not like we're, you know, with some other group of developed countries that value economic freedom. You know, the countries at the top of the freedom index, New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, they're all doing this kind of price regulation. The other thing that jumped out at me in that report is they have this chart about wait times for seniors in different countries, including the United States. And one of the things they show is that Canadian seniors face pretty long wait times. Some other seniors in single payer countries are waiting a little while to see the doctor. But then at the very bottom is the United States, where we have very short wait times for our seniors. Unfortunately, that leaves out the fact that like seniors are basically in a single payer system. Medicare, which is a government run healthcare plan. And fabulously, they have very short wait times. I don't think this is a case that single, for me, it's like not a case that single payer systems have short wait times. It's just like that is not the defining factor about whether you wait or not is whether you're in a single payer system.
Right. But they did also inadvertently make the case that the system that seniors have is like pretty good here in the United States. And like it would be great if we could just give everyone that system.
They disagree that that was the case they made, but
they, Chairwoman Cliff? Oh.
Well, Trump's going to kind of run the numbers one more time. He's going to open up his drawer, go through the plans, really kind of crunch the numbers. Yeah. I did want to ask you before you go, we've been talking about this Medicare for All plan and this vision for 2020. One thing that is on the ballot this November is Medicaid expansion. There are four states that have gotten Medicaid expansion via Obamacare on the ballot in Republican states through amazing activist movement. Yeah. Can you talk about how activists have brought this to get on the ballot and what hopes are of actually passing it?
Yeah. So, there's four states where they'll see Medicaid expansion on the ballot: Idaho, Nebraska, Utah, and Montana. So if like not exactly a group of liberal states. And I think, you know, what's interesting about these states, they're places where either the legislature or the governor has, you know, decided they don't want to expand Medicaid. And we're just kind of seeing a totally new strategy to do that. This kind of follows on. Maine was the first state where people voted to expand Medicaid by ballot initiative. That happened in 2017. Unfortunately, Governor Paul LePage has refused to follow through on this, despite multiple court orders to do so. But it seems like in the other states where this is on the ballot, the governors are not quite as ardent as Governor LePage, and they are planning, if people vote to expand Medicaid, they say, like, yes, we are going to follow the will of the people. It's a pretty big deal. You know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who could gain health insurance if these ballot initiatives pass. And it really is a lot of grassroots activism. I think one of the things that's really interesting is that these are places where Obamacare is definitely not popular. There was some really interesting polling from Boise State University around the Idaho ballot, where they asked people, you know, do you approve or disapprove of the Affordable Care Act? I think it got like a 35% approval. And then they asked people, you know, do you approve or disapprove of this ballot? And that got like a 70% approval. So Medicaid expansion polls much, much better than the Affordable Care Act. And this is actually, I think, you know, something that some of the drafters of the ACA kind of started expecting by the, you know, middle of the Obama administration, is that, you know, once Obama's out of office, once, you know, there's a little bit of distance between him and the Affordable Care Act, it'll be easier for red states to kind of embrace some of the programs in there. So most of them are like, most of those four ballots are polling decently well. You know, I wouldn't be, I think at least some of them will certainly pass, and there's a decent chance that all of them pass. So yeah, it's a really, you know, and I think if these four pass, then you might see the folks who work on ballots like going after the really big states that haven't expanded, you know, somewhere like Florida, where if you get Medicaid expansion in Florida, that's going to be like a huge, huge deal.
Yeah. And that's why, again, the governor's races are so important. I mean, Stacey Abrams has been talking about Medicaid expansion everywhere.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, so in Georgia, the challenge is the legislature also has to approve it. Yeah. So she's going to have to try and get the legislature on board. But I think there's a bit of a domino effect. Like if you see more red states expanding Medicaid, then it kind of becomes easier and easier for other states to get on board. Some fun Medicaid history. You know, Medicaid started in 1966, and it was an opt-in program, just like, you know, this one ended up being. And so it started in 1966. It wasn't until 1989 that all states actually had Medicaid. It took over 20 years originally for all the states to sign up. Arizona was the last state. So, wow. So there's your fun Medicaid history for the day.
And it seems like as we move further from the Obama presidency, it'll be less, as you said, it'll be less associated with Obama, and then Republicans will be more willing to support it.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case. So I think you'll see the kind of, you know, if these ballots pass, really the last holdout is the South. So if you kind of like look at, you know, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana. Well, Louisiana has expanded. So, you know, even you're getting inroads
Texas.
There. South Carolina hasn't expanded. So that's kind of the last region. And I would not be surprised to see folks who work on these ballots kind of focus there in the next wave of ballot initiatives.
It's going to be really fascinating. God, there is so much. The consequences of this election are just extraordinary.
And we only get to even really ever hear about like the very top line consequences. Yeah. Like this we barely ever hear about because Trump sucks up all the oxygen. But it's so fascinating how it tests and I think proves the proposition that, you know, once you expand social insurance, it's very hard to take it away from people. And people don't want to take it away. They come to really like it and depend on it.
You know, so I think that's like something that is proved true. I think, you know, Democrats originally expected once people got insurance that it would, that Obamacare would become popular. That did not happen. You know, people weren't really, you didn't see any swings. The thing that like needed to happen is there had to be a threat to take it away.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's the thing that like, you know, made people kind of mobilize around the Affordable Care Act. One thing we haven't even talked about is the majority of Democrats' ads this year are about healthcare.
Yeah.
Like when I think back to like the midterms I covered 2010, 2014, especially 2014, you know, after like healthcare.gov's like disastrous launch, no Democrats wanted to talk about healthcare. Now it's the thing they want to talk about the most. It's been like a really stark shift. And I think it goes back to this idea that, you know, once you have a social program and there's like the threat of taking it away, people start to think about it a lot differently than they did before.
It is truly incredible the degree to which we've come full circle because like as part of my job, I have to unfortunately imbibe Fox News and take on all the toxic fumes and radiation that comes from that. And they were just reporting on Republicans' positions on healthcare. And it was amazing to see this right-wing apparatus that had revolved around one of the defining political fights of the past, you know, almost a decade, has been around specifically Obamacare and repealing Obamacare. And then there are all these clips on Fox News of just like their regular healthcare programming when they talk about it is Republicans moving left on healthcare, like Republicans trying to embrace protections for pre-existing conditions and Republicans trying to assure people. President Trump's message to Republicans, move left on healthcare. And just to see the network that for so long they're defining political fight was talking about how Obamacare was this incredible threat to you and to the American system as we know it, now suddenly talking about how Republicans are moving left on healthcare to try to reassure people. It was truly disorienting.
It's really, you know, like I've been covering this for far too long, you know, since they were debating Obamacare. And like all the twists, like I did not think this is where we're going to be 8 years after it passed, that we'd still be having this debate. But, you know, time's a flat circle, and here we are having this.
Oh, wow. Rust cold. Nice.
I think Republicans are finally in kind of like a difficult corner with the Affordable Care Act. You know, if you look at any polling about the ACA, by far the most popular part of the ACA is the protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So like, I totally get why they're saying these things. They're not true, but I understand politically, like, why you don't want to be the guy to take away protections for, you know, people who have serious medical conditions. Yeah, it really is.
Well, in a lot of cases, you want to be that guy, but you don't want anyone to know that you're that guy.
Yeah.
Chairman Cliff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Anytime you want to talk health policy, you guys know where to find me.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sarah, thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly crying.
Lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.